Welcome back to the second hour of Rookwood Pottery, a Cincinnati treasure. Let's continue with the memories of Rookwood expert Anita Ellis, who co-wrote the book Rookwood and the American Indian, Masterpieces of American Art Pottery from the James J. Gardner Collection, and another book about the glaze lines of Rookwood pottery.
I am Anita Ellis. I was curator of decorative arts at the Cincinnati Art Museum, where I worked for 40 years and ultimately became the deputy director for collections towards the end. One of the things that I noticed as curator of decorative arts when I first got into it in 78, I was assistant and didn't become the curator until 81. I was looking around the collections to see where the greatest pieces were. The one thing I noticed was Rookwood pottery was really sensational. I knew a lot about pottery because in undergraduate school, I had a dual degree in art and art history. And in the art end, I took ceramics. So I knew what I was looking at. And I was looking at these pieces and realized that the Cincinnati Art Museum had a very unsung collection. Now, you got to realize this was in the early 80s when people in Cincinnati made fun of Rookwood. But I was sitting there thinking, you know, I got to change your mind on this, because Rookwood became the greatest art pottery in the world by 1900. And it wasn't because we said so, the French said so. So that's when I started to get into Rookwood in a very serious way, to catalog the collection, to see what we had, to see what was missing, and to go after those really choice pieces that could fill a big hole in the collection. And that's how all that got started. Now, with Rookwood, you have to understand what the atmosphere was like in the country, the cultural atmosphere, when Rookwood was started. By 1859, Cincinnati was the largest industrial city in America, second only to Philadelphia. And because of industrialization and the degradation of industrialization, you know, industrialization moves in, you take the family from the farm to the city, the parents have very long work weeks, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. They get paid almost nothing. They work in squalor. They have very dangerous work environments. They come home. They can barely feed their children. The homes are in squalor. They don't necessarily have good running water or sewerage or anything like that. So there was a call for reform that was brought on by the degradation of industrialization. The English-speaking countries looked to one critic. His name was John Ruskin. He was the leading British philosopher and art critic of the Victorian age. He said that beauty uplifts the spirit, it inspires the soul, and this is important, it transforms character. In short, beauty around you makes you good. That sounds almost funny to us today, but they were deadly serious back then. So if a woman's husband was a Lothario or ne'er-do-well, and her children were all good for nothing, it was her fault because she failed to put beauty around them in the home. In fact, society charged her with beautifying the home, and the home was seen as a temple. And the one way she could do this was by decorative pottery. She could decorate pottery and porcelain for the home. This is one, not there were many, but this is one aspect that the woman could do to beautify her home, because beauty around you made you good. And you could see that in the schools here in Cincinnati in the last, the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. So with that, we go to Mariah Longworth Nichols. Mariah married her husband, Nichols, in 1868. in 1870, she had her first child, Joe, and in 1872, she had her second child, Margaret. By 1880, we know from oral tradition that Maria and her husband did not get along. Her husband, George Ward Nichols, like any bad marriage, the woman wants to get out of the house. And Maria had enough money to do anything she wanted. Her grandfather, Nicholas Longworth, when he died in 1863, he was the second richest man in the United States. Think how much money you would have today. Think how much the second richest man in the United States has today. Tens of billions of dollars. She could get anything, and she wanted to get out of the house. In 1876, she went to the Philadelphia Centennial Exhibition. In that exhibition, in the Japanese compound, she was blown away by the Japanese ceramics. I mean, just enamored of it, just taken aback. And she wanted to decorate. Remember, women's society gave them kudos for decorating the home, and one way to do it was through decorating pottery. So the women at the time here in Cincinnati, because Cincinnati was a major ceramic city, they would get pots from, say, Dallas Pottery. They would decorate it, take it back to Dallas, and Dallas would fire it with its commercial ware pieces. And when it was over, they'd let the women know, and they could come and pick it up. Well, they were firing for commercial ware. I mean, it was a profit-making organization. They were doing this as a favor to the ladies. And the ladies, their pieces could get fired out. You know, if you fire too high, the colors get lost. Fire too low, and they flake off. They had no control whatsoever over the firing aspect. It wasn't perfect. Mariah didn't like it. So in 1880, in April of 1880, she went to her father and said, I want a Japanese pottery. And she wasn't kidding. She wanted her father to go to Japan to find a pottery and to bring it, all the materials needed, and employees to Cincinnati so she could have her own Japanese pottery. I mean, this is how much money she had. This is what she was used to. Well, he said, no, I'm not going to do that, but I do have a schoolhouse down by the river, and I will finance you to turn that into a pottery. And she did. That was in April. In November, I think it was November 27th, which was Thanksgiving of 1880, they drew, which means opened up and took out fired pieces, they drew the first kiln. Kiln or kiln. Kiln is spelled K-I-L-N. The British do not pronounce the N. They call it kiln. I studied under an Anglophile. In my classes, I was not allowed to pronounce the N. You can say kill or kiln. So she started her pottery. She hired her women friends, who were all ladies of station. They were rich. As such, they did not need a full-time job. Indeed, they did not need a job at all. It would have been a blight on their family if somebody thought they had to work. It was a pastime sanctioned by society, this pastime. Rookwood hours were Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., with a half an hour for lunch and short breaks at 9 a.m. and 3 o'clock. And they worked on Saturday from 6:30 a.m. to 1:15 p.m. This is a six-day work week. It was common in the United States until the Great Depression, when FDR reduced it to a five-day work week to try and spread out the work so more people could get employed. Now, the women worked piecemeal. They got paid by the pot, not by the hour or the week. And as such, they came to work when they wanted. They decorated as many pots as they chose, and they went home. And Mariah soon learned that this was not a viable business plan. She says, quote, my somewhat expensive experience convinces me that to rely upon women's work for the decorative department of Rookwood would be to fail entirely. And when she's saying that, she's talking about her women friends, all of whom didn't need to work. When you get down into the blue collar, there were women who desperately needed to work. Women could be nurses. They could be teachers. There was almost nothing else they could do if their husband died or whatever circumstances in life led them to support themselves. But they could work if it were in the arts, and in this case, at Rookwood Pottery. But Mariah wasn't talking about them. They came in and went the 8 to 5 and the 6:30 to 1:15, et cetera. But Mariah was talking about her friends at that time. So she gets started. She hires men. Men work full time. Men don't get married and leave. Men don't get married and have babies and leave. And she prefers men to women. And throughout her whole life, you see this, her preferring men to women in terms of who got paid what, because there were women who were outstanding decorators. In 1887, Kitaro Shirayamadani, who was a Japanese artist, came from Japan. She hired him to decorate at Rookwood because, remember, she was enamored of the Japanese ceramics. And in 1887, he was paid $15 per week. And the other men were told not to talk about their salaries or it might upset him. Now, what that means is they were getting paid more. An experienced male decorator could make up to $150 per month. Newcomers, women, began at $3 per week. This is in the mid-1890s. Bessie Brain, for example, began in 1898 at $5 per week. And if you were good, that might go up to $7 per week the following year. So the highest paid decorators were all men. And only men were sent abroad to study. You have artist Van Briggle. He was there a long time. I was there from like January of 94 to June of 96. I mean, William Watts Taylor, the director, ultimately sent Van Briggle a letter and said, "We're not paying you to live in Europe. Come on back." Albert Valentine, William McDonald, Matt Daly, Kitaro Shirayamadani, they were all given a salary and a stipend to study in Europe. Wareham went to Europe, but he was only given a stipend, not a salary. Women who went abroad, Bessie Brain, Anna Valentine, Grace Young, Sally Toohey, Virginia Demarest, these were all really, really good decorators. They had to pay for all of it themselves, and they had to quit Rookwood to go. And there was no guarantee that there would be a place for them at Rookwood when they returned. So there was definitely, and it's terribly 19th century, actually it's 20th century too, there was definitely a gender bias. And it didn't bother Mariah at all because she was into the gender bias, even though she was a woman. I can tell you that in the book on Mariah Longworth's door, the recent one by Constance Moore and Nancy Borman told me not a couple of weeks ago that she has since come across a letter about Mariah. And with the 1920 successful suffrage movement for women, that spawned an anti-suffrage movement by women. And the vice president of that anti-suffrage women's movement was Mariah. So she was against suffrage for women. It just went on and on. She was not concerned about the woman's plight. And she had more money than she knew what to do with, so it wasn't a concern of hers. Also, she didn't need the vote. When Theodore Roosevelt, for example, in about 1896, when he wanted to formulate his political future, he invited Mariah Longworth Store and her husband, newer second husband, Bellamy Store, to Sagamore Hill. That's Roosevelt's hilltop home in Cove Neck on Long Island, New York. Now, Roosevelt and Mariah rode out on the sheltered waters of the bay to discuss Roosevelt's political future. And notice, Roosevelt did not discuss his prospects with Bellamy, who was an American minister to Belgium. At the time, he had been a two-time congressman. I mean, this is the man. He's in the politics. He didn't take him out. He took his wife out because she had the purse strings and she could literally pay for a president. And so this woman, she was so rich, she didn't need the vote. She could determine who was president just by how much money she could donate to the cause. So her first husband died in 1885. And in 1886, 6 months and one day, I think it was, after George Ward Nichols died, she couldn't have gotten married any earlier because 6 months was the grieving period. So 6 months and one day, she married Bellamy Storr. Now, she had been dating Bellamy Storr when her first husband was dying of tuberculosis, and it caused quite a scandal, and the family just said, well, she needs an escort, and Bellamy has been kind enough to be her escort to function. Once they were married, she started getting into Bellamy's political plans, and she grew farther and farther away from Rookwood. And some people say, well, that proves that the only reason she had Rookwood was because she wanted to get out of her unhappy marriage, first marriage. That may be true. Storr, from 91 to 94, was a congressman. He got diplomatic posts. He was minister to Belgium in 96, Spain in 98, and ambassador to Austria-Hungary or Vienna in 1902. I mean, by 90, she no longer cared about Rookwood. She was into her husband's political future. Now, from 86 to 90, she more and more and more grew away from Rookwood. And in 90, the books say she deeded over Rookwood to her manager, William Watts Taylor. In fact, she didn't deed it over. She sold it to him, and he incorporated. And that's where we get all the records. She was not a record keeper. But once he takes over, there are records. In 1890, remember, they were down on the river in that old schoolhouse that was not big enough. It didn't have what they needed, and it flooded. So he plans to build a new pottery in Mount Adams, beautiful Mount Adams. And it was going to be a beautiful Tudor-style pottery. Because remember, beauty around you makes you good. In Mount Adams, you had the Art Museum and the Art Academy. So it took 2 years to build. And he started moving into Mount Adams. You had to move a department at a time, an inspection, in January of 1892. And from that time, he, as a man, took over. Almost everything on decorations on the pots were floral, flowers. In 1887, they got into a little bit of grotesque figures, little elves or ghosts or figures from children's nursery rhymes, stuff like that. Well, when William Watts Taylor took over, he didn't want it to be a woman's pottery. He wanted to sell to men. And so he encouraged decorations that would sell to men. So all of a sudden, you start seeing things like monks drinking wine or drinking beer. You see forms like beer pitchers or beer mugs, tobacco holders, all this kind of stuff that is geared towards men. In 1893, you have artist Van Briggle painting an American Indian on a charger, two of them, matter of fact, that were in the 1893 Columbian Exposition. They liked that. That sold to men. 1894, you didn't see anything. It's like, well, why not? Well, Rookwood was bringing out three new glaze lines, and the new glaze lines, Indian motif, didn't fit with the glaze lines. But that said, by 95, 96, all of a sudden you had treaties with the Indians. The Indian issue was coming to the fore. Everybody knew names like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, General Custer, the Little Bighorn. So all of a sudden, he decided, let's try the Indian portraiture. Now, you have to understand, portraiture is extremely difficult. That's got to be the hardest thing you can do to decorate on a pottery. His people were so good, they started it. Now, you also have to know, and this is very important, Mariah, because she didn't think her decorators were getting good enough training at the Art Academy, because she hired them out of the Art Academy. Her father underwrote the Art Academy, so it kind of keeps it in the family. He underwrites the Academy, and she takes people from there for her pottery. She got Frank Duvenet, a Cincinnatian. He was in Boston at the time, and brought him to Cincinnati and said, I want you to teach a life class that's figural, the human form, and portraiture. He taught it for her from 1891 and 92 and 92, 93, two school years. All of her decorators took it, and all of a sudden, you see them painting portraits on Rookwood. And the portraits they start painting, because it sells, and it sells to men, are American Indian portraiture. It sold extremely well, and you have to know that at the time, people in the United States, they had this dual attitude towards the American Indian. It was a schizophrenic attitude towards the American Indian. It was at once sentimental yearnings for a simpler way of life, because that's what industrialization brought on, for that simpler way of life. And that included a nostalgic adulation for Native Americans. At the same time, an American imperialistic drive necessitated Indian removal. So you have this love-hate relationship with the Indians. All this was going on between, say, 1895 and 1900, and it circled mostly around the Indian plight, because they personified the schizophrenic mental set amongst Indians. And so that's when they sold these incredible portraits. One critic, his name is Barber, he was the foremost ceramic critic in the United States. He saw these pieces, this portraiture, and he said, ceramics can go no farther. This is the greatest thing. They're better than anything in Europe. They're better than anything anywhere else in the United States. This is the foremost pottery. And then by 1900, Rookwood goes to Paris for the Universal Exposition and wins not just a gold medal. Gold medal is when you do one thing really good. A Grand Prix is when your whole company is considered, everything you do in your company is considered better than anybody else. Rookwood won the Grand Prix for 1900. Sometimes many people today consider it the greatest industrial exposition of all time. And it was in Paris. And the judges were French. And they're the ones that determine this. So you couldn't go any farther. So what happened with the American Indian? Well, it went out of favor. Americans were, by the turn of the century, were more concerned with expansion, with colonization. Puerto Rico, Cuba, Guam, your Philippines, all these places America was expanding to. Because in 1893 at this Columbian World Exposition, an historian named Frederick Jackson Turner delivered a historically sentimental address. Well, sentimental. How about seminal address? He said that everything unique about Americans was due to the frontier, the sense of energy, the sense of freedom, and above all, identity. And when we no longer had it, and supposedly by that time, the American Bureau of something or other declared the frontier closed, he said, now we are just derivatives. We are European derivatives. And his lecture has been called the single most influential piece of writing in the history of American history. So without question, the greatest portraitist of the American Indian was Grace Young. She came to Rookwood in 1886. Then she left. She was one of them that went overseas to study. Remember, she had to quit everything and pay for it all herself. She studied in Munich from about 92 to 96. She was back at Rookwood. They took her back. She was so good. Rookwood took her back anytime she said, I want to be back. She was in Rookwood from 1896 to 1903. Her portraiture of the American Indian was sympathetic and probably one of the greatest things of its type you'll find on ceramics anywhere in the world. When she left in 1903, American Indian portraiture left with her. You saw one or two pieces at the 1894 Louisiana Purchase Exposition, but they were usually pieces that were dated a year or two before. And you could see a couple of things later in different glaze lines, because Rookwood was trying to come out with bigger, better glaze lines, but it was not the same empathetic, artistically critical in terms of technique and psychology that you had during that period. Nonetheless, great things came out. Women still worked at Rookwood. Women still got paid considerably less than the men. And Rookwood continued. I always say Mariah Longworth Nichols made Rookwood. William Watts Taylor made it great. He died on November 12, 1913. Once he died, others took over, and it did well, and certainly in the 20s, it had a little resurgence, a little renaissance of really great things. They weren't going to international expositions anymore. It was way too expensive, and since they were number one, they didn't feel it was necessary. And then came the Great Depression. By 1931, all of the decorators at Rookwood were let go. You had three people working at Rookwood. You had the kiln master, you had the glaze master, and you had the potter. And that was just to keep things going so it wouldn't collapse entirely. They were making pots, but the glazer just kind of dipped them or poured them in pots. It was just to try and keep it going. People weren't buying. Nobody had any money. They started up again in the 40s, right before 1941. And of course, in December of 41, there was Pearl Harbor, and much of what Rookwood Pottery's period used had to go to the war effort. The lead that they used, all kinds of things that we don't even think of that they use in pottery, went to the war effort. So they had to come up with non-leaded glazes, etc. 45, they tried to get started again, and they did for a little bit, but they didn't have the greatest decorators there anymore. You had E.T. Hurley, he was there. Kataro Shirayamadani came back from a stay in Japan. And it limped along into the early 50s, and then it was in bad shape. Around 56, they went to Starkville, Mississippi, because the labor and taxes were cheaper there. None of the decorators would go to Starkville. And so that pretty much put it into hibernation. It wasn't until recently when Marilyn Scripp bought it and started reviving it. She's an incredible woman. And Rookwood is doing fairly well now. It's working. Most of its day-to-day money comes from interior, especially kitchen, bathroom, wall decorations, the tiles. They are, once again, they are spectacular. They brought in a ceramic engineer from, I think he was Seattle, Jim Robinson, and some great potters, and they started working. And once again, when they went to conventions, they couldn't get on the grounds of the first convention, so they just got a room in a hotel where all the conventioneers were staying. Well, they had people coming to them. They had so many appointments with so many different buyers without even being on the ground that Rookwood was really starting out. You can tell when you look at Rookwood, you look into it. You don't look at it, and that's a huge thing in pottery. And this is true of Rookwood during most of its lifetime. Pottery, if you look at it, fine. But if it has a psychological pull that draws you into it, so you're not looking at it, you're looking into it, that is great pottery. That's what Rookwood had with its unique glazes. The glazes were hair thin, and yet they look very deep. And with the decorations, the portraitures and others, you could just look at it forever. I mean, that is what Rookwood made. Is still working, and I couldn't be more pleased. It is a feather in Cincinnati's cap. Cincinnati has, at last, with the help of Randy Sandler and a couple others, brought Rookwood to the fore. So we can be very proud of this first-rate, internationally first-rate pottery. And in terms of prices, in the heyday, one pot, the highest price, went, and it was a spectacular Shirayamadani piece. It was black iris, which is probably the highest costing piece of Rookwood that you could get. And it had electro-deposited floral decoration on it to go with the birds, etc., on the decoration. That one went for, I think the hammer bid was $300,000, and then with the buyer's premium, it went for $350,000. Normally, pots at that time, an Indian pot, could go between how big it was and who did it, between $5,000 and $50,000. The regular day-to-day pots, they could go, if you got a really great iris glaze, you could pay $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 for it. Nowadays, you're talking about $1,500, $2,000. When they were made, in the beginning, when Rookwood made things, they sold them by size, and they could be $3, $5, $7, $10 for the tallest ones. And Rookwood would never let its decorators sign them. Well, Rookwood needed to keep track of the decorators. That is to say, if you became a decorator, they kept track of the things you made, and if they didn't sell, within 6 months, you were out of there. So in 95, after people kept asking them over and over again, we need to know who these initials are, Rookwood finally put out a catalog with a list of the names of the decorators. When they got into Native Americans, all of a sudden, size didn't make a difference. It's who painted it. So it evolved. Nowadays, the taste for anything Victorian has passed. Everything is mid-century modern. And Rookwood did come up with a lot of good pieces in the late 40s and 50s. People don't recognize them. You don't see them too much. But there were some really good things. But today's prices are one-tenth of the biggest prices. Maybe for something that was $10,000, you would pay $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 for today. Mariah never did come back to Rookwood, although she did go to the fairs and would report back on how well Rookwood was doing. She always took pride in it. Cincinnati loved it. When by the 50s, Cincinnati wasn't enamored by it, and people weren't enamored by the pots they got for their wedding. So it comes and goes. What doesn't go, however, is Cincinnati's pride in Rookwood, because it is, without question, the greatest art pottery in the world. After art pottery, what happens is studio pottery starts taking over. Studio pottery today, the vessel aesthetic, pots, are no longer high on the hierarchy. Sculpture is. And it's harder to make big ceramics than it is to make small ones, because big ceramics will slump in the firing because of the weight. So technically, you have to get stuff real right for that. So it is harder. And usually, they're more expensive because of it. But that's where ceramics, that's where Rookwood went.
Well, I want to go back to 1895 because I was fascinated by the encampment of the Cree Indians at the Cincinnati Zoo. Yeah.
And this happened, sadly. You get, kind of like a carnival barker mentality, a promoter. And the Indians were dirt poor when they were moved out to the reservations. And a promoter would go and say, come with me, I will set you up. We will have shows. Now, you have to understand, Buffalo Bill Cody, William Cody, set up Wild West shows with real Indians. And he ultimately retired a millionaire. So these promoters would see that and say, okay, so they'd go up to the reservation and say, okay, come on, let's set them up and have, with these Wild West shows, Indian shows. And the Indians said, okay, they needed the money, et cetera. What they do, these promoters would do, they would take all the money and then leave the Indians destitute wherever their last show was. Just so happens in 1895, their last show was across the river in Bellevue, and the promoter left them and took all the money. Well, the Indians had no money. They had no way to get back home to the reservation. And so the Cincinnati Zoo and a number of prominent Cincinnatians went to the Indians and said, look, if you come to the zoo and continue with your Wild West shows and what money you make on it, when you make enough to go back, then you can go back. And the Indians said, yeah, we'll do that. And they did. It brought more people to the zoo than ever before. People loved these Wild West shows, and the Indians loved giving them, even when the Indians, in the end, usually lost. But that's okay. They were okay. They're very practical people. When they made enough money, they packed up and went back to the reservation, thankful. And it's really interesting that a number of Rookwood artists had personal friendships with some of the Indians at the Cincinnati Zoo. And they would write to them. The Indians would write to them and say, do you think we could come back to the zoo and do it again? And the following year was very rainy and it didn't work. So the zoo wasn't in a mood to do it again. But it's very interesting to read these letters from the natives to Rookwood people, and to see how close they were. And you get a sense of why the Rookwood artists saw these Indians. Now, they took some of the Indians, I will argue that some of the Indians were taken from this encampment that Rookwood painted on pots. The portraits on that were photographs they used, you could tell they would eliminate some things and keep other things. They would make the portrait very sympathetic at a time when that wasn't necessarily the case with Native Americans. And they became good friends with them, and you could tell that there was a relationship between Rookwood and the Native American.
Could you talk about the vase that Grace Young decorated of Geronimo.
Oh, Geronimo. You know, Geronimo, you have to know that Geronimo was a Pueblo Indian. Pueblo Indians aren't pugilistic. They are not fighters. And they don't wear eagle head feathers. They just wear a band of cloth around their head. So they weren't necessarily the ones that got painted. The Plains Indians were the fighters. Well, Geronimo took his family, a wife and several children, up to the edge of the Mexican-United States border, and they set up a little encampment there. And he told his family, you wait here, I'm going to go in to Mexico, and I'm going to get all the food, et cetera, that we need and do the bartering and stuff, and then I'll be back. And then we can go back to the Pueblo. Well, he did, and when he got back, his wife and all his children had been killed and burned to death. Everything, the teepee, everything they lived in had just been massacred. And Geronimo said, that's it. I will fight the white man forever. He was a vicious fighter. He came to be known as a vicious fighter. When World War II, the aviators that jumped from the planes, when they jumped, they would yell, Geronimo, because when they went into battle, they asked St. Jerome, in Spanish, Geronimo, to help them. And that was picked up. And they could not catch him. He was indeed very stealthy. And finally, they did catch Geronimo. And when they did, they paraded him around. Literally, they took him to parades. And he got to be very well known. And he is painted on a loving cup. It's an irony, isn't it, to have somebody like Geronimo painted on a loving cup? I mean, Rookwood, always the decorators were always saying something. Loving cups are sometimes called Teague's, T-Y-G. That's what they were called during medieval time, and they had three handles on them, and they were big, and they filled them with something to drink, and then at a meal, they would take this one mug, a Teague, and they would hand it from person to person. Each person got their drink out of it. They didn't have individual mugs or glasses, et cetera, back then. Ultimately, it got called a loving cup because everybody drank from it. And I think that Grace Young, and she did this a lot, was probably saying something by putting Geronimo on a loving cup. Like, Geronimo, we love you. We understand you. It's subtle, but it's there. And Geronimo sold. He would sell his face. People knew him. He didn't have the feathers. Right? Mostly that's what people wanted, warrior feathers, because this was being sold to men. Don't ever forget that. The Native American pieces were being sold to men, and men loved them. And Grace Young was the all-time finest of the Native American portraits. She was really quite spectacular.
And that loving cup is one of the pieces of the 52 that is in the James J. Gardner collection.
Randy Sandler, who was proprietor of Cincinnati Art Galleries, told Cincinnati, anything Cincinnati, including Rookwood. And I was visiting him one day, and he said, you know, there's somebody who's collecting Rookwood, and he's just getting started, and I think you should go see what he has. Fine, be happy to. And it was Jim Gardner. For as busy as he was very gracious and said, come on over. And he showed me his collection, and I could tell immediately he was a discerning collector. He didn't just buy because he could afford it. He bought because he wanted a particular piece, and he always had a reason. He had pieces by Mariah. He had the earliest pieces, which were the Limoges decorations. He had everything going into the standard wear, and he had a history, a little history of Rookwood in his collection. And his personal collection, he said, these are mine, he said, were the Native American ones, and he collected Native American portraits. He had some of the best pieces I've ever seen. Ultimately, years later, what I wanted to do, because I think it's one of the areas in Rookwood where you could pretty much tell it embodies the whole story of Rookwood, not just American Indian, but through the American Indian, you could get a whole sense of what Rookwood was about. I asked Dr. Susan Main if she would join me because I didn't know what an Indian was wearing earrings. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the hair plates are. I don't know whether if they're longitudinal, they're women. If they're horizontal, they're men. I don't know those things. And And she was an ethnologist, and she went out to the res, as she said, to the Rosebud Reservation every summer with her students. So she joined me, and we went to visit Jim. And I said, Jim, I want to do a Rookwood Indian exhibition. Could I use your pieces? And he said, he got really excited, and he said, oh, yes, yes, of course, what can I do for you? And he said, who else's are you going to get? And he meant that very honestly and happily, you know, and I said, no, only yours. And he goes, mine? Just mine? I said, yes. He goes, oh. And he almost cried. I mean, like, it didn't even dawn on him that something like that could happen. But his was the finest collection. You could use his to tell the great story of Rookwood and the Native American. And so we did. He's very philanthropic, Cincinnati, because he did so quietly, never knew everything he did for Cincinnati. It was a great deal. And he was such a gentleman. He worked very hard, and he married a farmer, and the farmers owned Cintas, and they made uniforms for companies. And the father of the farmers, Jim and the farmer, the boy, went to school together at Xavier. And Jim ultimately married farmer's sister. Well, the father, his company, collected rags. You know how he used to throw out rags all the time? Well, his father collected rags, and he would clean them and put them in bundles and sell them. And Jim was married to Joan. They were working this, and the farmer brother went out and collected the rags, and Jim said, yeah, I was in the basement with a wringer washer, and I was washing all of them, and we were getting them clean, and we were getting them dried, and we were putting them in bundles. And the brother said, we can do better than this. Let's try it. And so they got together, and they worked very hard and ultimately came up with Cintas and did very well. And Jim said, this city has been very good to me. I am going to be very good to this city. And he is. He's just one of the finest gentlemen I've ever known. His Rookwood collection was expansive. He didn't collect just be collecting. He learned. He studied. He knew why he collected every piece. And it brought him great joy. And it brought Cincinnati joy. And now it's bringing the Gardner Center and anybody that goes there great joy. So I couldn't be happier about that.
There are two plaques by Van Briegel in that collection, which are unusual compared to the other pots that are in there.
Yeah, those were done in 1893 for the Columbian World Exposition in Chicago. They're unusual in that they are Indians engaged in activity. One of them is making wool for clothing, spinning it, and the other one, I think, is drilling holes in shells for decorations. With those, it isn't the Indian himself that's the subject. It's what the Indian is doing. That happened a couple times, certainly in those two pieces. But once Rookwood really got into the Indian, that switched portraiture. Then towards the end, the one person who could do it and do it better than anybody else, Grace Young, did start doing scenes of Indians on horses, scenes where they were engaged, Indians were engaged in activity. And, you know, when you did that, it took longer to do. And Rookwood was, in fact, a business. And so the longer it took, the less you made, right? I mean, time was money. And so I think there was a reason why they started to do just the portraiture. But when Grace Young said, forget it, I'm going to do more than just portraiture, they let her because she was so great and she was also very fast. They all talk about how fast she was at creating these images, whether they be Indians riding horses or just a portraiture in and of itself. And they did simplify the Indian from the photograph. That is to say, if the Indian had a printed shirt on the Rookwood pot, the shirt wouldn't be printed. It would be a plain shirt because it took time to put the print on it. And time was money. And as a decorator, you got paid with how many you got out. I mean, it was important. If you took a long time, even though they were great, and you only got 3 out a week instead of 3 a day, you could lose your job. So most of them did simplify it, except Grace Young. She didn't care. She was so good, and they never stopped her, never. So some of the later ones by Grace Young are, once again, Indians engaged in activity. And she left by 1903, and it was the later ones that she did, I think, that were really so stunning. And they missed her. She was an asset, but she was a woman. So she went off and ultimately married Rookwood's photographer. There are so many individual stories within Rookwood, like Grace Young, that need to be told. And hopefully someday that will happen. And I think it will.
Finally, how many pieces of Rookwood pottery do you own? And what are some of your favorite pieces?
No, I don't. As a curator, you cannot collect what you curate. That's against policy. But I do have an apple. Looks just like a red apple. And it is made by Rookwood, modern Rookwood, and it was given to me as a present by the docents of the Cincinnati Art Museum when I was retiring. And that's my one Rookwood piece, and I absolutely cherish it.
This is Micah Carroll with Rookwood Pottery. I am the president of Rookwood and have the wonderful opportunity of carrying this legacy on into the 21st century. Rookwood today is quite an exciting and vibrant atmosphere. We like to refer to it as a renaissance here, as we have such a proud history. This year we're celebrating our 140th anniversary, and we have a lot of different things going on surrounding that, from our traditional holiday open house that happens at the end of each year around November. But we also have what happens every single day at the factory, which is artisans working in collaboration to really create exceptional world-class products. And another exciting facet of that is here at Rookwood, we have weekly tours. With COVID, we are doing that in a more limited fashion. It's a unique opportunity to really appreciate not just the name of Rookwood, but the quality that goes into it. And one way of really seeing that is our tours is going through each department that shows the handcrafted nature and really what separates Rookwood from anything that you can just go buy off a store shelf. We have about 8 departments. But we like to say there's 13 different pairs of hands that touch each product that go through our factory. And that could be from a holiday ornament all the way down to our architectural tile that clads a lot of homes. We know in the historic areas of Cincinnati there are a lot of old Rookwood tile, but that's still something we carry forward today. And it's a beautiful accent to any home. And you get to see that product going from fruition of the molds being made, to dyes pressing them and people cleaning them by hand and then hand glazing them and loading them into kilns for firing, all the way to the exceptional standards we have for our quality control and packaging.
Last year, July of 2019, you opened up a store in the Kenwood Town Center.
Yes, we did. You know, it was a fantastic opportunity for us. Cincinnatians all have heard of the name Rookwood and are semi-familiar with the brand. But we've always had the goal to make Rookwood more available to more people. And the Kenwood store location is a great way for us to do that. It's a nice kiosk. We've adapted it so you can shop from the outside. You can shop online from that kiosk as well. It has a broad variety of products, but it's a small sample of what we really do well and what our flagship store in the OTR has to carry. They're pieces of Rookwood in a timely fashion, and you get to handle it, which I think is really important, and it's an important differentiation of Rookwood versus anything else. It's not just something to look at. The quality can be observed through the handling of that. So the Kenwood store is just a great opportunity for us to do that for our consumers.
And you've also got a line of commemorative tiles that include Music Hall, Fountain Square.
Yes, we do. You know, that whole relationship was kicked off with Macy's quite a long time ago. We started off commemorating these Cincinnati icons, and it just seemed to pair well with Rookwood anyway because Rookwood has this big collector base. But these tiles are modern representations of what's out there, so it could be Fountain Square, we have the Carew Tower, Union Terminal. There's just a lot of these different pieces, and they're done in a myriad of different glazes. We have beautiful handcrafted, locally sourced frames to frame them in, and they're great for gift giving. So that's just one example of that from a partnership that started and we've carried on. We also do a lot of things with the Western and Southern. We are the trophy producer for the Western Tournament here in Cincinnati. We also have some collaborations right now going on with Sam Adams, and Braxton Brewery just released their holiday gift from Rookwood, which is a gorgeous stein. We've just always been of the mindset that if we're in Cincinnati, we should be of Cincinnati.
And you also produced a trophy for the Scripps National Spelling Bee as well.
Yes, we do. And let me tell you, if you've not ever been there or seen it, it is an exciting atmosphere. We did a full trophy remodel on the year that they had their eight-way tie. We ended up producing seven more trophies so that everyone that won got a trophy. And the year prior to that, we also made a small commemorative piece for them as they celebrated their 90th bee.
And, of course, the big promotion is Fiona.
Oh, man, yeah. Fiona Madness, it is here to stay. She's not just this animal at the Cincinnati Zoo, but she really embodies the spirit of Cincinnatians. Every year we release something new around holiday time, which is typically an ornament. And then we also do a piece around the first of the year to celebrate her birthday. And her birthday is January 24th. And a portion of our proceeds, it's actually a good portion, 20% of all proceeds sold, go directly to the zoo. And it's just a great relationship to keep and maintain.
I attended Fiona's third birthday party that was in partnership with Graders and purchased one of the ice cream bowls that was produced for the event. Lauren Long and Gary Simon were integral in designing that piece.
Correct. To get to partner ice cream with Fiona and Rookwood, it was just such a fun opportunity for us. Gary Simon is our sculptor and has more talent in his pinky than I could ever hope to have. And the same goes to Lauren Long. He's such a talented illustrator and visionary. Getting to play with his artwork and put it on ceramics was kind of a dream come true for us. That bowl, I think, sold out in under 24 hours, and there were lines at all of their stores. So, you know, something with Fiona's name to it and some really talented artists usually creates quite the scene.
I'm Lauren Long, and I am a Cincinnati, Ohio-based author and illustrator for children's books. I had the fortune to work with the Cincinnati Zoo and create a poster for the zoo with all of their animals. Interestingly enough, I did not include Fiona because I created that poster about a year before Fiona was born. But I included a little baby rhino, and it was a poster called Zoo Babies. And much to my surprise, Graders Ice Cream contacted me when they were creating their new flavor, Chunky Chunky Hippo, to kind of celebrate Fiona's life and make it two Cincinnati favorites, the Graders Ice Cream and the famous Fiona Hippo, on a carton of ice cream. And then Rookwood Pottery got involved and created an ice cream bowl. They asked me, along with Graders, to kind of partner up with all of them and the zoo to do art for the bowl. So I did a drawing kind of in the round, or like a flat drawing, so that it would wrap around and repeat on the outside of the bowl. So I designed the Fiona ice cream bowl, sculpted by a Rookwood artist.
The sculptor was Gary Simon. Did you go down to the Rookwood Pottery and work with him on the actual bowl?
No, it was definitely separate. I had a little bit of a communication back and forth with Rookwood, but I didn't meet Gary until we did a signing down at Rookwood together. So I submitted a two-dimensional drawing based on a template that Rookwood provided for me of the size and down to even the curvature of the bowl, so that I would know not to put too much of an important part of my drawing in a certain curve of the bowl, just to highlight to make sure it showed well. That was the biggest change for me, just to know that this drawing, which normally my art is always seen flat on the printed page, but to know that this was going to be then adapted into a three-dimensional piece. So essentially what Gary did was he took my drawing and I shaded it to give him a little sense for the value structure of my drawing. He took my drawing and worked his magic and made it into basically what is a little relief sculpture. And he worked with clay, and then they make it into a mold and fire it and glaze it. I did get to go down to Rookwood beforehand. I didn't get to meet Gary at that point. I got to take a tour of Rookwood, but then I also got to see the bowl, the light color, and different glaze samples. So I got to be part of that, choosing the glaze, which really is such a cool part of it. And I was down there with Tim Philpott from Graders. We were kind of like, okay, the double chocolate chip would look really good in that color bowl, and then the black raspberry chip would look really good in that. What color glazing will look best with chunky, chunky hippo flavor, you know? So it was fun.
Last week, the Frolicking Fiona ornament went on sale, and Gary Simon was part of that also.
Yes. Now, everyone knows that Fiona is a giant ham and loves to ham it up for the cameras and the people at the zoo. And you always see little images of her swimming up to the window and showing off. And Gary really encapsulated that in this new ornament that's coming out this year.
And Rookwood can be seen on the outsides of buildings all over the Rhine. And the current architectural division of Rookwood is busy also.
Yes, we have a world-class architectural tile sales and development team. Rookwood really has the talent to help people envision what something could be and then help them execute what it will be. Our tile, you're right, it is all over the country. One of the most interesting ones is in the Masons Temple in Milwaukee. You'll see some of the most vibrant colors on the outside of a building I've ever seen. The inside of the Carew Tower, the subway system that was being built, it's just everywhere you look when you're really looking for it. But the modern day is so much more, and it's something we've worked really hard on to make available. I think when people traditionally think of Rookwood, they immediately say, oh, I can't afford that. But we've worked at using technology to really bring prices down to get it in as many hands as possible so that not only can the people that have wealth afford Rookwood, but people that place value in Cincinnati should be able to have Rookwood. So we have a million different shapes, glazes, and colors that you could possibly imagine.
And what are the plans for next year?
Oh, we got a lot of plans for next year. We're working really hard on that. We will be doing some Fiona things coming around the first of the year to celebrate her fourth birthday coming up. And we have an exciting piece that will be coming out for that. Gary Simon is going to be working on that, along with some of our local artists here in the building that have done the actual design work, not the sculpting work. But we're also expanding a lot of our different lines. We have a hand-thrown line that is just some of the world's best pottery that you'll ever see. Vases and hand-painted ornaments and figurines. And every year around Thanksgiving, that's actually the first time that Rookwood's kiln was ever opened up. We do a kiln opening to celebrate and commemorate that first day in our history. And so we'll be having that this year around our holiday open house. But that's also for next year. It's something we really hope to expand on is we're investing in our artist studio here internally and really making more hand-thrown, 100% handmade pieces available to the masses because it is art that stuns the eye and stirs the soul. It's just beautiful things. And our goal is to get into dinnerware. We really want to have ceramics surrounding people from on their dinner table to in their bathrooms and their backsplashes from a tile perspective. Because we like to think of Rookwood as celebrated and positioned in some of the most intimate areas of your life. And typically that's where you start your day and end your day and eat in between. And I think our consumers would agree the things that we have right now really embody that.
You've been listening to the special Rookwood Pottery, a Cincinnati treasure, on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. You can visit the current Rookwood Pottery Factory at 1920 Race Street in Over the Rhine in downtown Cincinnati. I'm Lee Hay.